part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, with everyone on the line, should we just begin our chat?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, awesome. Great. Well, let me see if I can get everyone's names pronounced correctly. I'm going to start with Lynn because she just taught me how to pronounce her last name. So on the line, I have Lynn Yoshii, correct?
Yes.
Nailed it. All right, great. I also have Desiree Proctor and Erica.
Yes.
Is it Harold?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I got lucky. It was either going to be Harrell or Harrell. You know, I should really ask people in emails to tell me how to pronounce their last names, but I just roll the dice and go with it, and hopefully it all turns out okay, but looks like it's turned out okay, correct?
Yeah.
I got lucky.
Yeah.
Well, and my name, as always, is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast, and I have three wonderful creators on the line. Whose book I love. I love this book. You know, I also want to, you know, thank Barbara and Bryant Dillon from Fanbase Press for setting this up for me. This is a great book. The name of the book is Nuclear Power. They sent it to me and I read it and I was like, this checks off all the boxes for me. When can I talk to these ladies?
Thank you so much for having us and for having us on your podcast.
No, well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time. I mean, I have a lot of like questions but like I said, this checks off all the boxes for me because A, I'm a fan of, you know, it's going to sound like I'm a member of the Legion of Superheroes from the future or something, but I'm a big fan of like 20th century Cold War history. I'm a big fan of dystopian sort of like, alternate histories. And I'm a big fan of, I don't know if I should say it, the third thing that I'm a big fan, because I don't want to spoil anything in the book for anybody. But in the end, I'm a big fan of this book because it's just super cool. So I'm going to let whoever wants to sort of give me that, or give the listeners the elevator pitch as to what Nuclear Power is about, because I don't want to spoil anything, like I said. I will leave you to spoil anything for anybody or not spoil anything, but who would like to explain what Nuclear Power is about to the unwashed masses out there?
I can take it. So we like to say Nuclear Power is sort of like X-Men meets Handmaid's Tale. It's
nice.
An alt history take on the Cuban Missile Crisis. If the Soviets and the United States had, you know, each nuked each other on Black Saturday in 1962 and caused World War III, and what our country might look like today,
uh-huh.
A military dictatorship that's stuck technologically in the 1960s. And so our main character, Dr. Claudia Tachi, learns that the government she works for is keeping a dark secret from its people. It's basically systematically exterminating humans just for being different.
Yeah.
So that's kind of our elevator pitch. Very dark, very mature. But, you know, if you like spies and espionage and a little bit of like superhuman abilities and, you know, you're in for a ride, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this is a great read. And it's funny because, I mean, you said superhuman abilities, and that was a thing that I did not want to spoil because that sort of like comes towards the end of the first issue. Because up until the end, it's just it is very sort of like straight up like dystopian. It is very much like a world. Well, I mean, I don't know, you know, looking at the past year, but a world that is much worse off than our own, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it isn't revealed until the end of the first issue about the people with the superhuman abilities, but since it is such a big part of the theme of the story, I don't mind spoiling that a little bit.
Sure.
But yeah, Erica and I were really inspired by, you know, Both of our mothers are Cuban. And so, you know, when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, my mother was living in the States, and, you know, she was, you know, privileged enough that her family was able to pass as, you know, white and sure. American, but they definitely had to stop speaking Spanish, their native language, just kind of stop doing all the things that made them Cuban. They lost contact with a lot of their family members. And, you know, it's so, you know, that really had a trickle down effect throughout the generations. And, you know, I don't want to speak for Erica, but I know her mom had a very similar situation trying to Americanize when she got back to the state, because, you know, just fleeing this dictatorship of a country, you kind of want to put that all behind you and just become as American as possible. So, like, the world of nuclear power and the country that's formed in the 60 years since our fictionalized version of World War III, that country kind of looks like what Cuba is today, where it's technologically still very much in the 60s with, like, the 60s cars and everything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Desiree said, like, when, you know, my mom came over in the early 60s from Cuba when she was a teenager. And like Desiree said, it's like her big goal was like, I need to Americanize as quickly as possible, because she was seen as an other. So it's very much like trying to lose her accent. And she immersed herself in, you know, fun things like watching Dallas and becoming a fan of the Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, wow.
Trying to, like, learn English by watching soap operas. And that's why I'm actually named Erica, after Erica Kane and All My Children.
That's awesome.
So, you know, we were very, you know, heavily inspired and, you know, by the Cuban Missile Crisis, because it affected our lives, even though we were born much later. So we were just really interested in that time period and doing research.
Sure. No, I mean, it's in. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that Desiree, Erica, and I, not to leave Lynn out, have something in common to a certain extent, because I'm not Cuban, but I'm Colombian. And I understand that, you know, my mother, to a certain extent, it's hysterical that you say watching Dallas, because it's that is something that I did with my mother when I was young. Like, we would watch Dallas, Who Killed JR, and all that stuff. And right. But it's very interesting, because it may have been a different situation, but I know that for me, it was very much like, yes, there is a desire to Americanize, but there was sort of like a Colombian pride at the same time, which confused me growing up, because it's like, you are an American, but you're also Colombian. And it was like, depending on how my family felt at the time, it was like, which one should I be more proud of? But it sounds like you may not have had that. Did you have that Cuban sort of like pride instilled in you growing up as well?
Oh. I mean, absolutely not. My grandparents and my mom, they had to leave my oldest uncle behind because the military was trying to force him into service.
Oh, wow.
And they lost everything. They had, you know, their land seized, their jewelry taken, their every possession that they had. So they came to the States with literally nothing, which I think also influenced them being very distrustful of big government, and why a lot of Cubans tend to be very conservative Republicans is for that reason.
Yeah.
The old kind of school Republican tenet of, you know, saying like government shouldn't be involved in people's lives. Cubans are like, yep, that, you know, and there's a healthy skepticism with like too much involvement. And that also kind of played into, you know, our character of Claudia and Nuclear Power, and having her just, you know, be fully in on her government when the book starts, and be, you know, someone who served in the military of the American Union, and, you know, then learning a secret that like the government is keeping from its people. And that kind of like shatters her world a bit.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, obviously the sort of like espionage, or like the sort of the Cold War sort of like ethics, like setting is like very prevalent in here, like the sort of like government, like hovering over people and everything like that. So, I mean, part of what I was interested in, I didn't ask a question. Part of what I was interested in, is, you know, you said you weren't necessarily born during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but you were sort of, your parents were sort of affected by it. How did that filter down to you growing up? I mean, because I know that for me, I grew up in the 80s and still I have like a very, I mean, I still have nightmares about nuclear war to this day. I mean, every once in a while, I grew up in that, you know, the day after and Reagan and the, we're going to blow each other up and that sort of thing. But, and that is why I personally myself am fascinated with this era of history. Why were you drawn toward it to sort of like create this comic book? I mean, you said a little bit, but how did it become like a big thing in your mind?
Well, I think for going back to, you know, my mother and her family trying to Americanize as much as possible, my mom has a very vivid memory of her cousins having this, her cousin had this belt that had all these little Cuban flags on it. And her cousin like really wanted to save the belt because she liked the belt, but was afraid she'd be attacked for having these Cuban flags on her belt.
Oh,
so
wow.
Like trying to like paint over them.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, so my mom was spoke fluent Spanish, and she was 8 when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. And they were like, you have to stop speaking Spanish. So she stopped speaking it. And then when I was born, I wasn't really raised in that culture. So there's always been this like wanting on my part to know more about where my family came from. But then it not really being able to be spoken about, because
sure,
whenever it comes up, it's this like very sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, I've had this desire to go to Cuba and see this country where my like great grandparents came from, but I can't because that would just break my mother's heart.
Oh,
to
wow.
Go back there. So, you know, I think that's for us, it's like that all of this goes back to, you know, not only the Cuban Missile Crisis, but Fidel Castro coming to power and everything. So it's all within like this time period of the early 60s. So I think, you know, that's why I and perhaps Erica were just like fascinated with this time period.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I think there's a few lost, you know, generations of, you know, Cuban Americans and who, you know, feel who maybe grew up even more like immersed in the culture than we did,
mm-hmm.
who do just feel a longing for a past that they or their parents or grandparents never got to live because things were taken from them. And like, but at the same time, it's also like, well, look at the hope that this country gave to them.
Yeah.
Being able to come here when there was like the wet foot dry foot policy and being able to, you know, like even when Obama like loosened restrictions for, you know, families to come over from Cuba for sort of a period of time. I think that there was a lot of like reconnecting that happened in those few years. But then aside from like the Cuban stuff, like what was happening with North Korea about like 3-4 years ago also kind of was bringing us back to the brink of nuclear war. And we're like, that's so interesting because we thought it was new and scary, like, you know, a few years ago. But it's like, no, we lived through this in the 60s as well and came really, really close. And not a lot of people know about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, again, that period of history is really fascinating to me. And part of what, and, you know, to bring Lynn into this conversation as well, part of what I love about the book is how much, I mean, the inciting incident, correct, in like the very beginning of the book, or at least what opens up the book, is the, you know, nuclear war, or like, I don't, it's not full range nuclear war, but it doesn't destroy everything, you know, but enough to where the country is thrown into, you know, like there's only like 13 states left, right? Correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, 13 livable states. But what part of what I loved about this book and, you know, when I opened up to read it, you know, my digital copy, is the use of red in it, which, again, is associated, you know, at least to me, to, you know, the Soviet Union, communism, like that sort of thing. When you were developing this book, how did that decision come about? Because, you know, a lot of people would just do like black and white or maybe full color or something like that. And I don't want to scare people off, you know, saying that it's like a limited palette, because I mean, it is a little bit, but it's beautiful. It looks gorgeous. So how did that sort of decision come about? Because to me, it does look like Cold War, like Soviet or Cuban, like communist propaganda.
Yes, that was totally intentional.
Yeah.
So initially the whole color choice, well, it came from like a sort of a practical point too, because I will be doing all the coloring.
Sure.
As well as the rest of the art, is that I have to be able to streamline this. So a limited color palette would, you know, less choices, less time, what, you know, worrying about what color choices I should make. So that's why I do a limited color palette. Also, I was like a really big fan of Darwin Cook's. I don't know if you've seen some of his artwork when he uses a limited color palette, yes, like on Richard Parker series.
Yeah.
Those were beautiful. So it's like, you know what, try something like that. Although I think he does it better.
Oh, well, and, no, you do great. I mean, Darwin Cook is Darwin Cook, but I mean, this looks great.
So that was like the initial color choice of using red. We were kind of discussing covers of, you know, cover inspirations. And kind of wanted to have that totalitarian feel to the first cover. And so I made a Pinterest board and we shared and we all like contributed it and shared it and we talked about it. And a lot of it was the Russian propaganda posters that came out. And it had like a very avant-garde feel and they had their red limited color palette. So it's like, let's go for that look. And decided to go through, the whole entire series is not in the red color palette.
Oh, I was going to ask that.
Yeah, so it's going to change gradually, like for every scene change, or would a scene change be accurate, or is it sort of like, anyway when there's like a sort of like
location change.
A location change, yeah, a location change, maybe sometimes like a...
weather, we've changed it for like the weather, or kind of the mood or the tone that we're trying to get across.
Yeah. So there's like a different color palette every time for that one. So initially we'll start red, and then we'll have green, blue, and other colors that come in too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. Remind me, because I'm looking at the book right now. I mean, obviously the book opens up with the conflict, with the alternate sort of like, it's a nuclear submarine or something that's trying to get through the barricade or something of the Cuban, you know, of Cuba. And people make the stupid decision to, you know, launch the nukes, and obviously what happens. But the actual story, at least in this issue, occurs like how many years after the conflict, the initial conflict?
It would be like a modern day tale. So yeah, it would be like today.
Gotcha.
But it kind of has this older feel since, I mean, if you think about it, the space race never happened in this version of events. Civil rights movement never happened. So it's all just kind of like technologically still kind of stuck in the era of the 60s still, early 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit frozen in time, even though it's taking place today.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, and that's all part of like, again, the sort of like Darwin Cook, Bruce Timm, and their stuff to me... has always been a little bit sort of like retro, like back towards like the Hanna-Barbera cartoons of like the 60s and 70s and, you know, maybe 80s as well. But I mean, the look of the book is just fantastic. It looks great and quite, you're very welcome, because I mean, I was very impressed. That is one of the things that has always drawn me to comics was the art. No offense to the writers in the room. But the art was, and of course the fact that I'm very much like a history junkie for this era. And, I just looked at it and I was like, I looked at the first page with the hammer and sickle, like in that. And I was like, okay, I'm done here. Like this is, I'm in, I'm all in, like, here we go. And you know, the carrier and everything like that. So, and there's a little bit of a, it's not red and white. It's sort of red and sort of beige or yellowish, correct?
Yes. That was to give a little bit more of a, because it's sort of like a, it's to soften the red a little bit. And also because to give it like more, they're stuck in time and sort of like, So you kind of get like an overcast of yellow, seeming like everything's old and stale.
Yeah. Well, it's like the old comic book pages, like when, you know, they would fade a little bit, right?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that it's great. So one it's of the really, things. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, it's funny that you know, you're saying like, oh, what drew you to comics? Obviously, is the image. And for us, Desiree and I did the DC Comics writing workshop.
Oh, nice.
Where Lynn did the DC Comics artist workshop.
Oh, nice.
And we had an opportunity. Desiree and I had an opportunity to visit the DC offices, and we walked in, and there was like this huge whiteboard where artists could just like, you know, do little sketches on like dry erase markers. And there was this one drawing of Wonder Woman. And I was like, who did that? I'm obsessed with this person. We have to get her to do our comic. And that was Lynn. And it was like, I don't want to do this book unless Lynn's doing it. And
oh,
like,
wow.
You know, so we were very much fortunate to get her on our team. And she's done such an amazing job that we're like, no, we want to delete more words so we can see her pictures more. We don't tell that story, but it's 100% true. And she's like, guys, I think that you need to add some words here. And we're like, Matt.
It's like, you know, you could fill up some space here with some words. You don't have to like, no, it's fine. Like, okay.
That's funny. No, I mean, well, so the one question that I did want to ask you, Lynn, I mean, you said you were sort of like aiming towards like a Darwyn Cook sort of feel, but would this be your sort of like regular style? Is Darwyn Cook or that sort of art, like animation art, like that sort of thing? What people consider older animation art, retro stuff. Is that your normal style, or did you have to adapt your style to sort of like fit what was going on in this book?
I didn't really change my art style too much. The biggest adaptation was the coloring.
Gotcha.
Everything is pretty much the same how I usually do it. It's kind of hard to describe my art because from what I get from other people who describe my art, it's like, that's not what I intended it to be.
Oh, really?
I have no idea. Yeah, because I show my artwork to some people, and they'll say, oh, it's very anime, it's very manga. And I'll show it to some other people and says, oh, it's very Americanized, it's very American comic.
Oh, really?
And it's like, okay.
Oh, wow. So you're somewhere in the middle, I would imagine. And
I guess so. Very much like myself. Yeah, it really depends on who I show it to, I guess. And I have a lot of influences. Like, I loved all the Batman anime series from the 90s. I loved the X-Men comics. There's so many tons of Japanese comics that I probably can't even list, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
In this podcast, but yeah. So it's kind of hard to pin down how to describe my own style, but it is what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, again, I can't rave about it enough. It's absolutely beautiful. But sort of like turning back to the story a little bit, part of what's happening, part of what I found very courageous about this book is, you know, I don't even know if the right word is courageous, but very, a strength of this book was this occurs in... I'm saying a future from the Cuban Missile Crisis, but now in a world where, again, you mentioned Handmaid's Tale, where is it 25% of the children born are born with deformities, correct? Because of the radiation?
That's correct. They're having a population problem in the country, and so the new country, the United States, has reformed into this country called the American Union. And it's like the 13 remaining states that are centered around Chicago. Erica and I did a lot of research of what would have been the nuclear strike zones if the Cuban Missile Crisis had gone the wrong way. And basically both coasts of the United States would be gone.
Sure.
And so we realized, like, you know, the country probably would have reformed, you know, around Illinois. They're having a bit of a population problem because they're still dealing with radiation from the nuclear strikes that have like soaked into the ground and into the water.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when Claudia learns what the government is doing to perfectly healthy children under the guise of helping the mothers, it kind of like takes her on this journey to save every human life.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, and, but that to me was, part of the power of the story. I mean, obviously being in this world where something like 25% of children are born deformed, but the fact that there is an America now that openly embraces the practice of abortion, you know, and, you know, not to get too political. I am political, but it's, you know, and I'm of the belief that, you know, women should be able to choose whatever they want to do with their bodies, you know, but it's interesting to me how, you know, that there's no fear in this book of like that you're going to break somebody's brain by openly discussing it and saying like that it's a necessary act for this society to sort of flourish in a way, or at least they think it is. Can you talk a little bit about what made you sort of, because I'm not going to say it's in the forefront of the book because I don't want everyone to think like this book is about abortion, but you know, it is a thing in there. And to some, living in an American society where we're just like, oh my God, like, let's not talk about it. It was very cool for me to see this, that there could be an alternate history where, yeah, maybe this is what they have to do or don't have to do. You understand where I'm coming from?
Right. Yeah. It's such a hot button issue. And, you know, I grew up going to Catholic schools my entire life where, yeah, abortion was very openly talked about because it was the ultimate sin.
Sure.
And it was, you know, we had to watch graphic videos of like, you know, abortion clinics and things like that, yeah, in grade school. And so I never felt as though abortion was something that people were like, ah, you know, like so taboo about. It was just like, this is forbidden. And we, you know, wanted to sort of explore what it would look like if government was forcing, you know, these procedures on women, mm-hmm, versus our current country, which is like, it's always just a big fight of like, will women have access or the agency over their own bodies, or is it going to be taken away? And that kind of harkens back to, you know, we were talking about earlier with like the suspicion of Cubans and like big, you know, big government impeding on their lives, but also the like heavily religious aspect of, you know, Catholicism and other Christianity, who's like, no, absolutely cannot do that.
Yeah.
And you can tell people. So we kind of wanted to just touch on those issues and like, you know, balance like what that could look like in a comic form.
Yeah. We wanted to take
too preachy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without it being too preachy. We wanted to take the issue and kind of flip it on its head, while still very much making this, the theme still being like that women need to be informed about what's happening to their bodies so that they can make the decision, as to what like happens to their bodies. So it's still very much like that is still the message that we're trying to get across, but we're doing it by taking the topic that's so taboo today and changing the rules around about it.
Yeah. Well, that was the big fascinating thing, especially when I started to, after I read the book and I applied some thought to it, I'm like, this is interesting because this is a society where very much like the choice, like in today's society, they want to take the choice away for you to be able to do it. And in this society, it, like you said, you kind of flipped it around and it's like the choice is being taken away to be able to have a child that may be deformed or is not perfect in what this is, how this society views it. And I was like, wow, that's, I mean, I don't know if cool is the right word, but what you did was very impressive to me because I started thinking, I was like, well, so in this society, is it only the state that decides that you can have an abortion? Or if a woman, you know, had an affair with a man and didn't want to have the baby or something and was married, could she have it? Like, is the only reason you can have an abortion because, you know, and not to dwell too much on that subject because I don't want people to think like this book is about abortion. It's not. But like those are all the things that I started and that's started thinking about as while I was reading it and after I was reading it. And to me, that signals that you have a really good book because it made me think about stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, in that hypothetical situation that you laid out, it would probably be like the woman got pregnant, the government would make her do the test to see, you know, if she had the genetic variant. And if she did, she'd have an abortion. And if she didn't, they would probably be like, oh, you have to have the baby because of our population.
Sure.
But, you know, those are things that we like didn't have time to explore in 20 pages and then, you know, our 20 plus pages in six issues. But we did all think of that as very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love the way it sort of got flipped around. And then the lead character, she very much, because, I mean, the way it works in the society is they do a test and they determine as to whether the child is deformed. But the lead character is trying to figure out a way to stop the aberrations, you know, for lack of a better term, from occurring. That's correct?
Yeah, so the way that the citizens in this country think the test works is they think that this test will tell you if your unborn child has a deformity that will result in either like a death to the child, that it won't survive infant mortality, or that it could put the mother at risk in giving birth. In reality, the test isn't looking for that at all. Mm-hmm. It's looking for these advanced humans that the government thinks could be a threat,
yeah,
and getting and exterminating them before they're born, essentially. So, you know, it's the women are under the impression that this is a test that's keeping them safe. In reality, it's like tearing apart the family that they actually want in this case.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's not a, I know we were talking a lot about abortion. It's not a whole comic that's about abortion.
No, it's not.
Like pro or like, go ahead, Lynn.
It's more of an agency than abortion, I would think.
Yes. Yes,
yeah,
I agree. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. I was just going to ask Lynn, because I don't know what page I'm on right now. I'm scrolling through it, but there is an attack on the American Union border. And I see some what look to be looking like Avengers. I was like, are these guys? Is that like there's a dude with a shield? And they're not the Avengers. But I was like, did you decide to stick some Avengers in that scene just for like comic nerds like me to go like, ooh.
That was not intentional, but if you think it was cool, that's totally fine with me.
Yeah, no, I thought that was cool. No, because I see a dude with a shield. So can you all talk to me about, because as I was reading this book, I, you know, and before I got to the end or before I even realized that there were people with superpowers in it, I was very much, I was very enthralled in it, and I was like, okay, this is a world where this sort of thing is happening, and I didn't expect and again, why I said I didn't necessarily want to spoil anything in the first issue, but we've been talking about it. I didn't expect a presence of like superpowered things. And when I got to the end, I was very much, or towards the end, in the middle, excuse me, there is a character who displays his power, and I was like, oh, okay. But there was definitely a point where a part of me was like excited that there were like superpowers in this. And then there was another part of me that was kind of like, oh, there are superpowers in this. So can you talk to me a little bit about the balance of that? Because I mean, I know that in today's comic book, like reading like universe, there's a lot of people who like to trash like superheroes or superpowers and stuff like that. And when I began reading the book, it was like a very grounded, you know, alternate history sort of, but, you know, realistic in a way. And once you introduced the sort of like superpowered aspect, it seems to me like it could have, it could go a different way than maybe what I expect it to be. And maybe I'm not making any sense, but do you understand like sort of the question that I'm asking?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and I think for us, it was about, you know, telling the fun of telling a superhero story that's not from the perspective of someone with superpowers.
Yeah.
Where our hero doesn't have superhuman abilities, and she's still going to take on the big bad.
Yeah.
Even though she has a lot more to lose. And then on top of that, she's pregnant. And I don't think we very often see like that portrayed in comics of, you know, female protagonist, a pregnant female protagonist in the superhero world where she doesn't have superheroes. So that was very, very much intentional on our part to kind of just like sneak it in at the end.
Yeah.
And that's why we include like a hint of it in the middle of the comic, a hint of the superpower, so it doesn't just feel like it's coming out of nowhere at the end. So yeah, it was interesting trying to strike the balance, and I think we try to have the story focus more on like the relationship of the characters and this like new American revolution that's happening, and then the superpowers kind of just come into play and like cool action sequences that Lynn beautifully draws.
Yeah. No, that was sort of one of the things I wanted to ask about too, because I don't want to make it seem like it is a superhero superpowered book. At least this first issue is not, but at the same time, when it came around to sort of designing these superpowered characters or how they look, and how did that sort of work for the three of you? Did you have ideas? I mean, when you wrote the story, did you have ideas like what these characters could do? And then Lynn was like, okay, I'll design, you know, the physicality, or did you sort of like bounce back and forth, you know, like how they should be? How did the concept of these superpowered characters work for you? Especially being that they're not the center of the story, at least not in this issue.
Well, the Pinterest board,
you know,
helped.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say the Pinterest board that Lynn had helped, because I remember Lynn had posted some pictures of was it people with like lightning shaped scars or something on their body, Lynn?
Oh, wow. People who had been struck by lightning who were covered.
They looked like they had branches like or roots or just like burned onto them. I get it's horrible. It's horrible because they're bronze, but they also look very cool.
Oh wow!
Yeah, that was definitely an inspiration for like Reed's powers, and then we also did just a character concept document where we dropped in pictures of different actors that we thought would look like different characters for like reference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a collaboration kind of on both sides between artists and writers. And we also tried to like, you know, ground our powers a little bit in reality, you know, so because nuclear power is an energy, we kind of wanted, you know, Reed to have that energy, and like splitting an atom is like what his sister Iris can do, split her form. So we sort of tied it to that as well.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. That's great. Yeah. I mean, as a fan, I still, you know, I guess not ashamed to say, but I am a fan of like superhero stuff. You know, as an older man, it's like, oh my God. Like, but it's interesting to me how this sort of like trend has started happening. I see online where people like sort of like trash that sort of thing and are wanting, obviously comics should embrace like all different genres and stuff like that. But it was interesting to me to start off with this book thinking it was one thing. And then it still is that thing, but at the end in the middle, and then towards the end, it becomes more prevalent where it's like, oh, there's this other added thing to it. So you're able to sort of, it's very clever how you're able to sort of bring in, you know, people who might be into like, again, espionage, alternate history, you know, Cold War sort of things, and add a dose of like the superpowered in it. But I don't want to give the short shrift to your protagonist, like your main protagonist. Can you talk to me a little bit about her development? Like what thoughts you were thinking when you were putting her together? Because like I'm your typical comic fan. I guess I get too, in this interview, I let myself drift a little bit more towards the more fantastical elements of the book, but this is a very human story with a very human central character. Can you talk a little bit more about her?
Sure. Absolutely. Like with, you know, Claudia, she's a woman who has grown up in the American Union. She fully believed in her government and like believes that they're doing everything right by their people. And so that's what led her into doing her mandatory military service, but then continuing on to like work as a doctor serving the AU. And, you know, she's a bit, we didn't want her to like be naive, but because of, you know, like Desiree mentioned earlier, like the civil rights movement never happened, but because the population is like also so low, like women somehow, like the feminist movement definitely didn't happen, but like women had to function within this society and like were able to, you know, become doctors and like have these positions, but she's definitely still kind of talked down to a little bit by her male peers. So we kind of wanted to lightly, you know, touch on issues like that of like, what if, what would have happened and what kind of woman would she be? Mm-hmm. And then she's also, she's married and she like would love to have a child with her husband. And, you know, she, because of the government policies, has had to have a couple of abortions already. And now she's pregnant and has found out that she's carrying this variant gene again.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, it kind of, the truth is starting to come out. And so it becomes like, you know, should I, can I protect this child? What does this mean? What does it mean for our family? And what does it mean for the government?
Yeah, no, I mean, I love her story. I love what, like how grounded it is. I love the scene where she's trying to pitch her test to the, like you said, the sort of like male military people in the room who are her supervisors. I mean, there's, it's, it speaks a lot to, like you said, the civil rights era, the, you know, maybe feminism never took root, you know, and during a particular time. But it's interesting to me how you sort of balance, because I mean, in World War II, you know, women went to work, you know, helping in the factories and building the planes and stuff like that. And sort of not necessarily equality, but the ability to sort of like take an active role in the society that they live in, you know, move to the forefront of that. I think that that's very cool.
Yeah, definitely. It became, in during World War II, it became out of need because there just wasn't enough people. There wasn't enough men around because they're all fighting in the war to do the work that needed to be done in the factory. So it was like a necessity that women went to work and they found some empowerment in that, which was, you know, stripped away once the war ended. And so that's kind of like the world that Claudia lives in. Is she is a doctor. She is a high ranking like military official. She's actually higher ranking than her husband. But it's not because the country respects women the same way they respect men. It's a necessity thing. There's just not a lot of people around.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, that very much comes through in this. And again, it is a great first issue. Part of what I wanted to ask, and it's, again, because I'm from an older generation, when I grew up, women, girls did not read comics. So like when I read something like this and it's an all female crew that put it together, I always want to know, like, how did you get into comics? Like, how did you discover comics? Like, what are some of the comics you loved growing up? I mean, Lynn, you spoke a little bit to that with like Batman, the animated series and things like that. But and Desiree and Erica, you all met through this DC, what was it, artist program?
Writer program is what Desiree and I participated in.
Okay.
But we've been a writing team before that for several years.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up, like, I loved comics. I read comics as a kid, you know, in, like, the 90s. And I loved, like, X-Men. And I loved, of course, Batman the Animated Series as well. And after college, when I moved out to Los Angeles, Desiree and I met through mutual friends. We had both been to the same college and we really bonded over going to Comic-Con, and we were going to Comic-Con as fans because we just loved, you know, all sorts of genre. And it's really cool that now we get to go to Comic-Con as creators when Comic-Con exists again in person.
Sure.
So, you know, that's that's just been something that I've been interested in my whole life. Like, I was definitely, like you were, drawn to like the images, and like as a child, I think you read a lot of comics and you're like, oh cool, like Superman's punching a bad guy, and like you don't realize until you're a bit more of a mature reader of being like, no, like Superman's like punching Nazis, like this is a bigger, it's telling a bigger allegory.
Yeah.
And those, you know, they're very impressionable, they're very important, and like they tell a lot of, you know, interesting and important stories that we need to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I'm a military brat, which you might have picked up on from the comic. That's part of the reason there's so much military influence. So like I moved around a lot, and just sitting in the back of the minivan when I'm moving across the country, it's like all I did was read, and read books, read comic books. In the 90s, I loved like Supergirl, and
really,
yes, and that was the one that people didn't really like. That was when she takes over that girl's body.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I know that after John Byrne, it was like a. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, was it the Gary Frank one with Peter David?
I think it might have been.
Yeah, I think I know.
Yeah, and she, because I thought that was so, it was so different than like the animated series and other portrayals of Supergirl, because, you know, she's a clone of Kara Zor-El, and she doesn't really, and it's all about identity. And then she takes over this girl's life and the other girl's identity and discovers that it's like, oh, she thinks this girl has the perfect dream teen girl life. And it turns out she was involved in like these gangs and stuff like that. And it was so complicated and messy. And I remember just thinking like, wow, I didn't know comics could get this deep.
That's great. How about you, Lynn? Of what dragged you into this this world of comic books?
So my parents are from Japan.
Okay.
They came to Hawaii in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So when I was born, they encouraged me to read a lot of Japanese books, and so they indulged me in comics. So I was reading comics pretty young. Like, so I wanted to be a comic book artist since I was 7 years old.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you guys know about this comic series. It's a Japanese comic series called Doraemon. It's about a future robot cat with no ears.
Yeah, I've seen. Is that the blue? He's blue.
Yeah. He's a blue roly-poly cat. It's a kid's comic. It is like 100% kid's comic, but yeah. Damn it, it made me cry. So imagine you're like 7 years old and you're reading this like really moving story about like this cat robot. He basically came to the future to help like this child from the past become like this kid is lazy. He's like gets bullied a lot. He's basically like a failure of a kid, and he's going to become a failure as an adult unless this robot cat intervenes and saves his future. And like somewhere around volume 6, he kind of accomplishes that, and they say goodbye, and I started crying. And I'm like, what kind of magic is this? And like, so the first story that moved me was like when I was 7 and I wanted to become a comic book artist since then. And I was pretty impressed by that story. And I still cry. I reread that story, and even as an adult, I read that story and I still cry.
Oh my God. That's so great.
That good of a story.
That's so great.
So Japanese comics, yeah, they didn't dumb down stuff for little kids. And I pretty much grew up on a very healthy diet of manga. And then like in the 90s, I found out about X-Men.
That's so interesting to me Batman. Because, oh no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
No. I mean, it's interesting to me because the three of you are saying like, oh, I started reading comics in the 90s. And the 90s is sort of like regarded by a lot of fans as like this, like really, I mean, at least with Marvel and DC, there's definitely a bunch of like stuff that came out, like the Clone Saga and, you know, the death of Superman and stuff that overtook like the main industry of comics that a lot of people like me, or, you know, maybe not a lot of people, but I know that you say the 90s. And then the other thing that fascinates me is, I don't know how to put it like politically correctly, but it's just like, you know, it's like the chest's out to here and the waistline's like really small. And I'm always fascinated by women who were able to get past that, because I mean, that was sort of the thing that turned off a lot of female readership, you know, back in the day. Like if I had a girlfriend or something and I was like, oh, here's an X-Men. And then it's like a picture of Rogue and she's like, you know, Jim Lee'd out, you know, for lack of a better term. So how did you sort of survive that era and maintain your love of, I mean, I would imagine you looked elsewhere, which is kind of what I ended up doing too.
Well, I also think it spoke to a character like Rogue, where it's like you see the image and you're like, whoa,
yeah,
that's certainly not me because I'm flat-chested right now. But you like are like, whoa, she's a badass. Like she's so cool. And she was still cool as a character in the 90s. Like for me, and Storm was like another one. And like, I remember like being distinctly on the playground and being like, the girls would be like, okay, like who are we going to be? Like who's going to be Rogue and who's going to be Storm? Like who's going to be Jean Grey? And like, you know, and you'd have to alternate during the day. Cause like, you know, you wanted to be all of them because they had unique powers and they're interesting, even though it was like, we were like A cups and we're never going to get that way. Like,
yeah. I think the storytelling was just, especially with those animated series in the 90s, the storytelling was just so good that, you know, as kids, we're so young, we are not really aware of what they necessarily like look like and what that means and what objectification is. We're just like along for the ride in the characters.
Uh-huh.
'Cause that just kind of transcends everything.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, there are definitely times I may be older than all of you, but it's just like, I grew up in a time where like growing up, it's like girls did not read. It was just like, it was like a diamond. If you could find a girl who read a like, it was like, oh my God, you exist, you know? So it's just so great. And now that I have a daughter, you know, she's totally into comics. Like she loves, you know, stuff, and she's reading things that are very different than, you know, because as a dad, you start to wake up and you're like, yeah, maybe not this, like what I was reading, you know, when I was a kid. So, but it's just so great. I remember being with my wife in a Borders when we had bookstores kids. That's when you went in and you bought a book from a store. It was this cement building and had a lot of books. And I just remember that they started having like a manga, you know, section, and going in and just seeing like with my, because you know, I'm the dude who likes comics. I'm the old dude who likes comics. And I'm looking around and it's just like all these teenage girls. And I turn to my wife and I'm like, where were they when I was, you know what I mean? And I think manga saved American comics. Like I helped save the American comics industry, despite the implosion that eventually occurred, like with Tokyo Pop and stuff like that. But it's just great to me that not only were you able to sort of like get past that and find something wonderful in the actual stories too, but now you're making like even better stories, because I mean, reading Nuclear Power, you know, there's none of the stupid, like male dumb stuff that you come across in comics that are made by guys, you know? So it's an evolution that I'm just like, so kind of excited to see. And I hope that that doesn't sound sexist in any way or ignorant in any way, but that's just kind of where I'm coming from, which is part of my excitement for your comic.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Like it has been really interesting to kind of watch, you know, even the comic conventions evolve over the years. Like,
yeah,
you know, like I was mentioning, when Desiree and I were going to Comic-Con like years ago, it was like we would be like, you know, a handful of women there. And now there's a lot more. And that feels great to like, you know, see more women at the conventions with us. And like we also, I think also the rise of like video games and, you know, female gamers has kind of like been a correlation to, you know, women also into comics, like comics and video games. Sometimes that nerd culture goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been able to not only write comics, but also write video games. And that's been super cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm very impressed with the first issue of this. I hope to be able to check out the rest of it, like when it all comes out. I mean, where can people find you directly? I mean, Nuclear Power is coming out, or is out, from Fanbase Press, right? But only digitally right now? Or is it coming out in shops as well?
The first six issues, well, the six issues are coming out digitally each month. The first issue comes out April 22nd. And so then issue two will come out in May, et cetera. And then the trade paperback will be released in October of 2021. Gotcha. To align with like the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, and, smart.
Yeah. If you pre-order the trade paperback now on fanbasepress.com/nuclearpower, you'll receive a bunch of exclusive signed art. Uh-huh. And Yoshi's or Lynn's artwork is just like incredible. Like I can't speak enough about like how great it is. I also just want to add, like Lynn isn't just like a great artist. She's also an amazing storyteller. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a tangent, but like there's been several times where, you know, Erica and I are so in our heads and we so know like what we're trying to say that Lynn will be this great third perspective for us to say like, you know, this isn't exactly clear. This section needs to be longer. We need to spell this out more. Mm-hmm. And like we've incorporated a lot of her story pitches into the script. And I don't think this story would be as good as it is without her as like our third storyteller on the project.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
And this is, you know, all three of our like, you know, debut basically comic. Like, I don't think Lynn has done a full graphic novel where she's done every single issue herself, including covers. And she did the coloring and she did the lettering. Like, I mean, she's really a powerhouse over there. And
boy, did I learn a lot on how to use Clip Studio Paint.
Oh my God. I love Clip Studio Paint. Yeah.
Oh, the things I have learned with this just one project, man. I can write a book about it.
That's it, as you probably should. You probably should. Or a YouTube channel at the very least.
I wish I had the time.
We're keeping her busy.
Well, no, that's sort of, you know, will lead me to, you know, my last question, maybe not, because I've kept you on the line for about an hour and I don't want to take up your whole evening, but, are you writing like when you write and you're going back and forth, is it like which comic, is it the DC comics? Like versus the Marvel method where it's like each panel is like spelled out because you went through that sort of process with DC, or like, how are you working or, you know, with your scripts? And then when Lynn gets them, how does that develop? I mean, you talked a little bit about that, but is it like full script?
Well, we started off doing the DC method because that's what we are taught. We were describing every panel.
Yeah.
And with our first issue, and we included some reference images. And Lynn was just like, please don't do this. The way you guys are doing your panels makes no sense. And we're like, good, we don't want to do this.
Oh, no way. Really?
Yeah. So it was like a relief to hear that. So we're like, okay, we can just focus on the dialogue and not have to put in panel direction. One looks like this. Yeah.
Right.
So a lot of it is just kind of like, we think this section of dialogue is about 2 pages. We think this section is about 4 pages, and then Lynn will look at it and be like, okay, that thing that you think is 2 pages is actually 1 page. That thing you think is 4 pages is actually 6 pages.
Oh, wow.
I feel like we eventually found a rhythm by about like the third issue. I remember with the third issue, there was one sequence that I had to hop onto the phone with Lynn, and she and I like went through line by line by line of like, you can take this line out. You can take this section out. You need to add more here. But I think we kind of fell into a rhythm halfway through.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was definitely like a process of just being like, well, how much is too much? And what kind of, if we had something very, very specific in mind, you know, we would of course like flag that to her. But if we mostly were like, let's see what she does. And like, when we get the layouts, like, we'll be like, ooh, this is so exciting for us. Cause it's like, you know, we love comics. So being able to like have an artist send you back pages, you're like, yes. Like those emails are like the coolest thing when she would send us things. Sure. And hopefully we weren't like too horrible on her on the notes process either.
Oh no. I mean, believe me, I've read a lot of scripts. And here's the thing though, your dialogue is so good that you really don't need that much direction. You know, some writers kind of go like, and then so-and-so is feeling this angry and going this tumultuous, and they'll like detail every single thing in the background where it's like that background they describe, what you're describing, what they would be looking outside the window, and that window is only going to be like a 3/4 inch small on that panel. Right. So,
oh wow. No. I'm like, no, yeah, that's great.
You're super economical, and like there was enough nuance in the dialogue that I could get everything. So
oh, that's great. That's great. What sticks out to me most is, and not to be a jerk, is that you went through the DC writing program or whatever it was, and then you ended up abandoning the method that they supposedly tout. So that's funny to me. But whatever works, people. It's whatever.
Yeah, it's
works.
Not lost on us either.
It's so great. That's so great. Well, okay, so this is going to launch Fanbase Press and on 4/22, correct? Which is this Wednesday, coming Wednesday, which is probably when this podcast will be up, correct? Did I get my date right?
4/22 is Thursday, but
oh, Thursday. Okay, excuse me. So the day after this podcast goes up. See, sometimes I mess up online. It's okay on the microphone. But and it's going. Is it Comixology and Fanbase Press? Like, are those the two places you can buy them? Or
To buy them digitally, you can buy on Comixology. And then if you're interested in purchasing the trade paperback, that's on fanbasepress.com/ okay. Nuclear Power.
But this week it'll be on Comixology.
That's yep. correct.
That's yes. great. And yep. it's called Nuclear Power. And yes. I have on the line Desiree Proctor, Erica Harrell, and Lynn Yoshii.
Yes.
Nice. Okay. I was putting so much, like, honestly, I have been thinking this whole interview about this. Like, I've got to pronounce that name correctly. So I screwed myself up there for a second, but then I pulled it out at the end. Please forgive me, Lynn. I hope you'll forgive me.
Saved it. Don't worry.
Yeah. Again, the book is called Nuclear Power. It is by Fanbase Press. Thank you to Barbara and Bryant Dillon for setting this interview up. Is there any place online where people can directly find your stuff? Like
I'm at Erica Harrell on Twitter.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm at Desire Yay on Instagram.
Okay, great. And Lynn?
And because people have trouble with my last name, my handle on Instagram is Proto Kitty.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to forget Yoshii now because I screwed it up for a second there, but I will never forget it now. And if you ever see me at a convention or whatever, you can be like, pronounce my last name before and I will try and get it right. I promise. I will not be that jerk. But thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I really appreciate your time. I love your book. Like, honestly, I can say, you know, I'm not blowing smoke up anybody's butts. Like, this is a great book. You should go out and get it. Digital, trade paperback, whatever. It's not just because I'm friendly with Bryant or Barbara in any way. Like, this is a great book. Like, and I do not blow smoke up people's butts on this podcast. So you have all done a magnificent job, and I cannot wait to see what the next, it's 5-6 issues in total, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So the next 5 issues brings, because this is, I mean, like I said in the beginning, this checks off all the boxes for me. So anything final that you would like to say?
No, just thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
No, I'm super excited to have you on. I love having great creators on, and you're all great creators. Again, the book is called Nuclear Power, Fanbase Press. This has been Part-Time Fanboy, and my name, which I hope not to screw up, is Christian Horn. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Check out Nuclear Power. I promise you will not be disappointed. And thank you for listening. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Boys.